Talk Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Dave Karzinski, and he'll be answering your most important questions on smallmouth strategies. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Dave Karzinski about smallmouth strategies. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They've been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, "With my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I'm convinced that Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing." Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to www.bigskyinflatables.com. That's bigskyinflatables.com. Before we introduce Dave, I would like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Now, you have two chances to win tonight in the drawing. If you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Dave's section that says click here to register for the drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Dave's book, Smallmouth, Modern Fly Fishing Methods, Tactics, and Techniques, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So if you're interested in smallmouth, you'll want to try hard to win this book tonight. And here's how you do it. You've got to be the first person to answer the question or questions we ask at the end of the show. Sometimes I do a two-part question. And it's going to be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. And it's the same text box you use to ask questions during the show. So listen closely and take good notes, and maybe you'll get the answer in first and win Dave's book. Our guest tonight is Dave Karzinski. Dave is a writer and a photographer specializing in sporting culture and narrative. Whether it's the glacial rivers of the Himalayan outback or the high country lakes of the Polish Carpathians, deep country, wild country is where Dave feels most at home. A former Zell Fellow at the University of Michigan and a recipient of the 2012 Robert Traver Award for Outdoor Writing, is a regular contributor to Outdoor Life, Midcurrent, The Drake, and many others. In addition to Smallmouth, Modern Tactics, Tips, and Techniques, Dave is also the author of From Lure to Fly, Fly Fishing for Spinning and Bait Cast Anglers. When not on the water or in the woods, Dave teaches creative writing and photography at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Dave, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. Well, and I'm just going to do a double check here because we had so many problems last show. Those of you who are out there listening, could somebody just in the question box send me a note saying, hey, you can hear us? And just want to double check to make sure that's happening for everybody. Already got some questions coming in. That's good, Lynn. Glad to see that. So somebody give me just a heads up and okay, and then we'll get started. Want to make sure the recording gets the best part of the show, which is not me at the introduction. So let me just
check. Great idea.
Yeah. Haven't had problems with this in the past, but since we did last time, I'm just going to be extra cautious.
Better to be safe.
Yeah. Sounds great. Okay, good. Thank you. All right, let's get started. So, lots of questions, lots of things to cover tonight, Dave. First of all, let's just talk about, and I'm, you know, kind of following along in your book, and you did a great job on your book, and I think you broke it out really nicely. And so we're going to kind of follow that format tonight. And first off, as you talk about rivers, in Paris in West Des Moines, Iowa, asks, where in the Midwest do we find excellent smallmouth bass fishing? So maybe we can start there on some likely places to fish.
Sure. Well, it's a great question. The easy answer is, where don't you have great smallmouth fishing in the Midwest?
Okay.
If you've got a larger warm water river, the Mississippi, the Wisconsin, some of the northwestern Wisconsin rivers like the Chippewa and the Flambeau and the Black, heading over to the eastern part of the state, the Wolf River and all of its tributaries, Wisconsin, it's not overrun with trout, it's most likely overrun with smallmouth. And so I think that one thing I'd say to all of your listeners is that there's a lot more smallmouth water than is, you know, named or talked about. This past summer, I had a lot of fun exploring tributaries of larger river systems that I fished. Rivers that are not written about at all online. Basically, if you've got depth and you've got connectivity to a warm water system, you can have smallmouth bass, and fishing can be really great.
What about some of the other characteristics of good smallmouth rivers? You mentioned the Mississippi, and, you know, that doesn't register with me at all. Don't they need a little cleaner water, clear water?
Well, you know, not necessarily. And by Mississippi, I'm referring largely to, like, the larger drainage, those tributaries and tributaries of tributaries of the Mississippi, so the St.
Yeah.
Croix and all those rivers.
Smallmouth
actually do very well in rivers that don't have tremendous clarity. I mean, you've got, you know, decent smallmouth fishing even in the suburbs of urban Chicago. My brother just moved to Naperville, and whenever I visit him, we hit DuPage for an afternoon. It's not as good as elsewhere, but it's surprising how adaptive smallmouth are. I certainly enjoy pursuing them most in a remote water. Some of my favorite places to fish them are in the northern Wisconsin Freestoners. But they can be found in a lot of places. I mean, you can catch smallmouth bass downtown in a lot of warm water systems. So we're looking for depth. We're looking for connectivity to bigger water. If you've got flowing water in the Midwest, again, if it has a temperature profile that characterizes it as a warm water river, it's up into the 70s and 80s in the summertime, you're likely going to have smallmouth bass there. In southeast Michigan, we've got a ton of smallmouth water. I currently live in Ann Arbor, so we've got the Huron River. We've got the Raisin River going up towards Saginaw. There's a number of tributaries that flow into those lakes. All the tributaries of Lake Erie hold smallmouth bass as well. So there's a lot of smallmouth water out there. So there's probably more good water than a lot of people know about.
I think there is, yeah. Dave, are you on a speakerphone by chance?
I have my Bluetooth. I can certainly pop it to my phone proper.
Can we try it and see if we can get a little bit better quality on your voice?
Yeah. Totally. Can you give it a whirl? How's that? Any better?
Yeah, it is better. It is better. It's clear.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, it was a little garbly there, so good. Okay. We had kind of...
Oh, sure. But can you maybe clarify that question and continue a bit further? Smallmouth, really, they show up in a lot of different kinds of systems. So you might have heavily impounded water. We've got dam after dam after dam. They'll be there. Free-flowing rivers with lots of tributaries that have decent spawning depth, they'll be there as well. But there's a lot of great smallmouth water out there.
I know in talking to some people in the Northeast, like up in Massachusetts or whatever, up in those areas, they talk about the river changing from trout to smallmouth, you know. And I guess there's a lot of areas like that where as the water warms up further down, then you start getting, you know, smallmouth introduced.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite fishing that I do is on those river systems where you have a gradual warming, where in the middle stretches, perhaps in May, when bass are still pre-spawn and the trout haven't moved up to the cold headwaters yet, you can catch both. And that's a really exciting time to be on the water. You might see fish rising to the first bigger mayflies of the season, and you're not quite sure if they're trout or smallmouth bass. So we're looking for slower gradient than a trout stream. We're looking for slightly warmer water. So on larger rivers that have both trout and smallmouth, there will be sections where we have both, and then eventually as the year wears on, where we find more exclusively smallmouth and more exclusively trout.
Right, right. Well, we got a couple questions that kind of tie together here. One question was, what are some of the best holding areas in the rivers for smallmouth? And I'm going to just join that with a question from Dino in Michigan. And he asked, when do you fish river bass like trout? So do we look in the same holding areas that we're used to for trout? Do they fish similarly to trout?
Certainly in cases, particularly if we have low water situations where bass are not relating to the banks, we'll have a lot of fish holding at the heads of holds in that prime lie feeding position where we'd really expect to find just about any kind of trout, brown trout, brook trout. So the fish is there. Do we approach it exactly the same way? The presentation portion of the program is going to be a little bit different. We do find them relating to deeper structure, especially early in the season. When they are deeper and they're in bigger water, we find them on the same kind of seams where we might expect to find trout on a bit of river on the Huron right near my house. It's a seam where you would definitely, you would nymph an indicator if you were fishing for trout
right.
In the early season. And for smallmouth, it's a really great place to swing a weighted sculpin pattern on, 6 to 10 foot tip in the springtime. So they're there, the approach would be a little bit different. So that's where I would kind of think of them as trout. But I think more often than not, thinking about them as trout is going to result in kind of a trout-centric approach that doesn't do, I think, justice to the uniqueness of the smallmouth bass. It is a different fish. It gets cajoled into eating in different ways. It has different motivations for eating. So certainly there are times where they're relating. I mean, they're a structure-related fish. We'll find them in the same places that we can find brown trout sometimes. We're also going to find them in places where we would not expect to find brown trout. So thinking about them as their own fish is a kind of a big part part of the book.
Yeah, better way to approach it there, yeah. Dino had a bunch of questions here, so I'll roll through these, some of the general, and then we'll kind of break out here later and talk about the different water columns and how we fish those, as you did in your book. So, let's try to address these maybe generally, and if we get more specific,
sure.
On, that's great. Dino says, upstream versus downstream presentation, are there conditions that favor one or the other?
Right. So I would most often, almost always prefer to fish downstream if possible. The only time I would really fish smallmouth upstream is if I really had to, if I was fishing very small water, or if the only way I could get a dead drift and I needed a dead drift would be to fish upstream. Smallmouth water tends to be a little bit larger than trout water, especially if we're talking about the kind of trout water that I fish in the Midwest. Often it's rather small. So that's one of the kind of rationales for kind of fishing downstream. Another is when you're fishing downstream, you can really slow the fly down. You can use the current to change the angle on the fly and the angle of approach. Your only option when you're fishing upstream is really to speed that fly up if, for instance, you were fishing a streamer or something. And it's also hard to get the kind of cross-current movement that bass find really enticing. As an example, one of the things that makes bass a little different than trout is fishing a streamer, say, quartering downstream. Bass really like the fly to be falling a little away from you. So one of the things that I like to do if I'm wade fishing and fishing a middle column fly, a streamer or something that sinks like a circus peanut, I'll make my cast, and I'll actually do perform a downstream aerial mend when I make that cast so that the water is grabbing the belly of the line. So rather than kind of swinging my fly like I would in a trout situation where its kind of nose is pointing upstream and it's kind of ticking slowly across the current is grabbing it, and by mending downstream, I'm extending my cast, and I'm actually moving the fly across the current at the same time as I'm dropping it back downstream. So it's a movement that bass respond to in a way that trout don't necessarily. So that's why I like fishing downstream where possible. You really get to use the current to control the path and the speed of the fly. Bass really do like to eat on the paws, and you can stop the fly in a lot of different ways when you're fishing downstream. Hard to stop the fly when you're fishing upstream.
Okay, good. Good answer. He also asked about muddy or high water or both conditions. Any special tactics?
Oh, absolutely. High water is really interesting in that a lot of people kind of sort of focus their efforts in the middle of the channel. They kind of fish it the same way that they might fish normal water. In high water situations, bass really press up against the bank. Depending on like how severe the current is, it might be the case that up against the bank is really the only, you know, easy flow for fish. So in those kinds of situations, a vast majority of the fish are going to be right up on the bank. So it might seem counterintuitive, but sometimes we'll be fishing up in people's backyards in those kind of extreme high water situations. It's the only place where fish get respite. So if you're fishing from a boat, say, and you're in a high water situation, you'd really want to be using presentations that are loud, big, and that are directed to the foot or two or three of water right off the bank. So we'd be systematically hitting that water, working it through that strike zone of several feet, getting the fly back in, repeating the presentation, rather than fishing the fly all the way back to the boat over all right. that heavy churning water that likely doesn't hold fish.
Right, right, yeah. To go along with that, Dino asks, what about fly color and water conditions? Is there a correlation in that?
Well, the general rationale is a darker color fly in darker water. That's been classic. Certainly that works. A lot of extra flash can be really effective. But in darker water, maybe even more important than that is the displacement of water that your fly produces. So one of my favorite flies of all time is Jack Gartside's Soft Tackle Streamer. It's just a piece of marabou wand around the hook. It's reverse tied, so it's got that thick part of the stem tied in at the butt section of the hook. It's hollow on the inside. It's a really wonderful, delicate pattern that you would never fish in any color in high water. It's just too subtle. It doesn't get noticed. In high water situations, you want to fly with a much larger head, a wool head. Wool is a great material for high, dirty water. It pushes a lot of water. Another fly that is featured in the book, not yet commercially available, but if you tie it around, it's really one to fly, is Russ Madden's Flash Monkey. It's got a larger profile. It pushes some water. It has a ton of flash. It really gets noticed in dark water. And dark water doesn't only happen during times of high water. There are some waters that fish in central Wisconsin, that are pretty dark all year long. So in that kind of water, I'm generally fishing darker colors, but I'm really thinking about fly profile, flies that push a lot of water and flies that might have a lot of flash. So think about head material, size of the head, and what kind of water displacement your fly is likely to make. That kind of goes along with lines as well. When you've got some larger head flies, especially mutually buoyant flies with large heads, you need a sink tip to get that thing below the surface. A floating line and sometimes even the intermediate is not enough to get it through the meniscus and get it swimming. So it's kind of an approach that requires triangulation of a couple different elements.
Okay. Another question from Dino. He was thanks, Dino, for all your questions. He's asking about Potamodromus migrating into rivers versus resident smallmouth. Do you use different techniques?
You know, I don't. I've treated them like the same fish. So in that sense, as a fish that really relates to structure, as a fish that really relates to edges. One thing I talk about in the book is the importance of developing kind of spot vision for smallmouth. So not only looking for edges, and an edge can be anything, it can be light to dark, it can be shallow to deep, rock to no rock. It's about learning to kind of see the world in terms of edges, which is how the smallmouth bass hunts, how it relates to structure. And once you kind of develop that edge vision, you can look for intersections of edges. So for instance, one of the edges we talk a lot about in the book is the edge between the first shelf and the second shelf. It's where the immediate shallow water off the bank gets, you know, much deeper. There's a great edge there. It's an even better edge if we have a sweeper, a logjam of some sort crossing that. At that point, I'm looking for the intersection of those two edges. If I'm thinking about a prime ambush lie for the alpha fish in that given area. So whether it's an anadromous fish or a resident fish, I'm still really thinking about edges, current edges, light edges, depth edges, substrate edges. I regularly do a walk on the Huron River near my house, and I'll stop on the bridge, and I'll occasionally watch smallmouth bass moving up and down the shoreline. And it's almost uncanny how closely they will hew to even the subtlest change. The water depth changes by 3 inches. And at that depth change, the cobble gets a little sandier. It's almost too subtle for the eye to see. And yet, when we watch a smallmouth work a shoreline and kind of swim very slowly up the bank, it's hewing really closely to that edge. So they're really an edge-oriented fish. It's where they hang out. It's where they hunt. So developing that edge vision and, again, looking for intersections of edges, that's how I kind of break down structure in any river I'm on.
Okay. Time to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dave Karzinski more about smallmouth bass strategies. Looking for that shot at a permit? Whipray Key Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island and are only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipray Key is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placencia. Once you're there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and you won't be taking long boat rides to get started. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for a tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit WhiprayKeyFishingLodge.com. That's Whipray, C-A-Y-E, FishingLodge.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Karzinski about smallmouth strategies. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use that text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Dave, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? And I guess writing this latest book on smallmouth was a huge accomplishment for you. But you got other things in the work, too, right?
Yeah, well, the smallmouth book was incredible. I grew up a devotee of In Fisherman magazine as a kid growing up in the Chicagoland area, and I consumed all the, you know, the how-to books under the sun. So as a form, it was something that I really enjoyed, and I always wanted to do one. So when I got the opportunity to do smallmouth, it was really quite fantastic. Other projects include, I've got another book coming out in 1 month. I was kind of working on these at the same time, back and forth. It's been a pretty busy year. The other book is, it's called From Lure to Fly, Fly Fishing for Spinning and Bait Cast Anglers. So if you already fly fish, and I suspect most of your listeners do, it's probably not the book for you, but it might be the book for your friends, your brother-in-law. Basically, it kind of, I thought about my own journey towards fly fishing, which began in my early 20s. I was a maniacal gear angler. I was fishing all the time. But I found that I wanted something a little bit more, and I turned to fly fishing. I didn't have anybody in my periphery who was into it. Where I was growing up, there were no conventional fly fishing spots. So I kind of taught myself. You know, it's a slightly different era. We didn't have YouTube yet. You couldn't just Google things, and it was a difficult transition, especially since so much of the language is identical but has different meanings. Line in line, for instance. Simple, but it was is a pretty major stumbling block for me. So I wrote a book that was geared toward spinning and bighead anglers that are already competent. They know how to read water. They've been fishing for a while. They understand they have fish, but you're curious how to target them with a fly rod. So it's multi-species in approach, starting with bluegill, going to bass, trout, pike muskie, salmon, steelhead, and carp. And what I'm trying to communicate with that book is that there are multiple entryways into fly fishing. You don't have to start with trout. You don't have to start with bass. I know plenty of folks who only fly fish for muskies. That was their entry into the sport, and maybe they go from muskies to trout. So we live in a pretty cool age where you can enter the sport in a lot of different ways. So that book is just trying to, enlarge our fly fishing community a little bit, and also indicate that there's lots of different ways that that can happen.
Good, good. All right. Well, that's, and any articles coming out?
Let's see. It's got a cool conservation piece coming out in the winter issue of Trout Magazine, the Trout Unlimited publication. It was a really interesting piece. I was looking at a lot of watershed restoration initiatives associated with the GLRI. So for folks outside the Midwest, GLRI is the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, the monster program that does a ton of work on the Great Lakes and restoring them to their, previous grandeur. And I was surprised to learn that the GLRI does not just mean those larger bodies of water, but the tributaries as well. So had a fascinating time hitting up rivers in northern Wisconsin and western Michigan and learning about what some of these abstract words like watershed conservation refers to on the ground. So a lot of connectivity issues in some of the larger Wisconsin rivers. So by removing culverts, you're giving fish access to colder water so they can manage their own thermal needs as, the season. Removing culverts also allows even more genetic diversity. Fish that have been kind of sequestered in various parts of rivers by these faulty culverts don't really get to interact with fish in other parts of the river. So that was a real eye-opener. Really interesting stuff happening on the Rogue River in western Michigan in terms of how an urban and suburban watershed can actually survive and thrive as a cold water river despite development. So a lot of really interesting and new stormwater management procedures in place. So
yeah, we'll be looking there for that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one more, I was in Patagonia, Argentinian Patagonian brook trout fishing in early March, and there's a story about that in the Winter Drake magazine. So,
oh, good.
Should look for that one too.
Yep, good, good. Thanks. Good. Well, let's move on to seasons.
Absolutely.
And Dino, again, as they says, river bass seem to target minnows and crayfish at different times, maybe insects or other items too. Are there seasonal patterns that seem effective?
Yes, there's seasonal patterns. Early in the season, when fish are metabolically slow, they can be more inclined to pursue something else slow-moving like a crayfish or a leech. That is not to say that these are necessarily hard and fast, fixed rules. One of the really cool things about Michigan's smallmouth season is that it opened up. We've got a couple more months of very early season fishing. Whereas we used to have to wait for the last Saturday in April, now we can fish much earlier in the season. So all kinds of experimentation went on. We have a relatively mild climate in southeast Michigan, so it makes it possible to fish. And I was getting my first fish on bait fish patterns 2 years ago in early March, which was much earlier than I was expecting to fish bait fish patterns. But it was a warm day, and it was heat of the day, and I just had a feeling that maybe the fish were ready to chase something a little bit faster. So one of the things that we talk about in the book is really letting the mood of the fish dictate your approach in terms of what you're throwing. For instance, early in the season, you might be vertical dredging, so you might be fishing weighted patterns with lots of passive material that kind of moves on minimal manipulation, fishing it slowly under a floating line, and kind of dredging up fish that way, almost a variation of nymphing for trout. Then one day, you lob out your meat whistle, for instance, and it gets hit halfway down. And that's a sign that bass metabolism and bass activity is picking up. Maybe you can get away with throwing a middle column bait, a Murdich minnow, or one of Mike Schultz's sculpin patterns. Then, one day, you find out that that fly that you're going to fish through the middle of the column, it gets eaten right as it lands. And that's kind of telling you, hey, I could now fish a topwater. So one of the big focuses of the book is kind of helping to teach anglers how to listen to their water a little better. Smallmouth water is really diverse. And one of the things I love about smallmouth is how different they are in different watersheds. So part of the cool part of teaching at the University of Michigan is I have long summers off. So I can head over to Wisconsin and check out those rivers and swing back to Michigan. I can stop in Illinois and fish some of those rivers. And it's really remarkable how bass populations in different rivers, they relate differently to structure. They feed differently according to what's in their river system, whether it's more of a bayfish-oriented population like the Wisconsin River, or whether it's a more crayfish-oriented population. So, yes, they – I'm just looking at this question again. They're keyed on at different things throughout the season, but another thing that we talk about in this book is less about, say, hatch matching. So even the question, what do I fish, that does get – that kind of speaks to that hatch matching trout, mindset where I have to imitate the food. And sometimes bass are very selective and you've got to go that route. But a vast majority of the time, we have thinking about the water that you're fishing first as opposed to what you want to be throwing. And for instance, if we're fishing a really shallow flat, really shallow, say, rock garden, foot and a half deep, bass are out there eating crayfish. That's great. It's going to be hard to present, especially if the water's low and clear, it's going to be hard to present a crayfish pattern to that fish. It's going to land pretty loudly. It's going to make quite a bit of a disturbance. Even though it's the hatch matching fish, we're matching, its forage, there are problems to that. We could throw a much softer landing bait. We can throw a Murdich minnow, a smaller Murdich minnow, which lands like a feather. We can throw a smaller topwater. So, and more often than not, that fish that's been, eating crayfish is going to see that offering, it's going to sit back and it's going to eat it, it's going to chase it. So that's kind of, we try to be kind of unconventional in a couple of different ways in this book. And that was one of the ways that we did it, was by thinking about water and making presentations based not so much on what the fish was eating, but what type of lure we could, what type of fly we could present to fish in that water. So that's a way that we kind of try to work against the grain of the trout-centric thing.
So kind of making the smallmouth think outside the box.
Right, and what? We think that, smallmouth do a lot of their thinking outside the box.
Yeah. Maybe probably more so than a trout would. Yeah. So don't you think they're more opportunistic than a trout?
Really, and that's one of the points that me and my co-author Tim Landwehr really drive home in the book is that they're more likely to check out something a little bit different and weird, and that's more likely to get their attention than something that looks like exactly what is floating by. Even in insect situations, you would not, in a trout fishing situation, you want to match the size, silhouette, color, stage of emergence. In a bass fishing situation, if you're lucky enough to live on a smallmouth river that still has good insect emergences, A lot of the urban rivers no longer do. You're better off with something a hook size bigger, maybe with rubber legs in addition to the hackles, maybe something that you twitch right on the bass's face. So that's a way that bass are a little bit different than trout. Even in those situations where you might have fish feeding on ephrons, you might have fish feeding on hex, there are going to be different reasons for them eating that fly. And also they're going to move around a little bit differently. Smallmouth streams, for the most part, are a little bit slower than the trout water. And whereas the trout will kind of, you know, take up position and let that conveyor belt of bugs come to them, a bass is more inclined to move around a little bit. So rather than waiting behind a fish and trying to get it timed, you're better off trying to cover that fish as soon as it rises. In that sense, it reminds me of the trout fishing that I've done in Chile, the dragonfly fisheries in the lake regions there. You're waiting for a fish to breach, and then as soon as the fish goes down, you're trying to drop your fly right into that dilating ripple where it crashed down, because you don't know where it's going to be next. It's on the move. Similar with smallmouth. I mean, you might occasionally get a fish that's rising in a consistent place like a trout is, but more often than not, it's going to be cruising a little bit, and it's about covering that fish up with a cast, having an offering that does something a little bit differently, and giving it a little bit of movement when it enters into what you think to be the zone.
Okay, let's take another quick break, and then we've got a few general questions on equipment, and then we'll dive into each of the water columns and talk about those. So hang with me, and we'll be right back. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams. And just so there's no mistake, they derive as much pleasure from helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience and coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing and snorkeling, while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved into the tactics used today. They're well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on tongas, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at www.bajaflyfish.com. That's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Karzynski about smallmouth strategies. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Dave, we've got a few kind of random questions here about equipment. Boris in Ohio asks, do you think that trout spay, also called micro spay rod and techniques, work well for smallmouth?
Yeah, I think they absolutely can have a place, but it's going to depend very much on your river, and it's going to depend very much on the kind of structure that you're working with. So to give an example, this past August, I did a lot of fishing, wade fishing on a really great tributary in central Wisconsin, kind of exploring new water, and all the fish were tucked back in wood, so deep into wood that you were almost skipping flies every time. It was wonderful, technical, challenging fishing, totally delightful, but they weren't coming out for the fly, and they demanded a kind of soft presentation, and your cast had to be point on, you know, aerial mend. And so if you're in a situation that really calls for precise fly placement, control over how loudly or softly your fly lands, and that's a big thing we talk about in the book, you know, through the season, your presentations are getting quieter. The water's getting shallower. It's getting more clear. So whereas in the spring, if fish are in 4 feet of water, you can throw a big, heavy streamer. It lands with a splat, moves to the water. It kind of gets their attention. That same fly, you know, in August is going to just empty out that hole of fish. So I think they can it can be a great tool for those situations, maybe especially earlier in the year, where you're fishing a little bit deeper, where you're fishing not up on the bank or tucked away undercover, but maybe where you're fishing kind of like deeper water edges. So great early season swinging technique. I think the switch rods could be great for that. One way that I've used, you know, I've just done kind of single-handed swinging with great success is on late summer, kind of mid-depth boulder fields midday. So I think one of the, you know, really great technique for a fish that have lockjaw midday, you've been catching fish all morning, things kind of disappear. For fish just kind of hanging out in these kind of mid-depth flats, and they can be really difficult to get to eat. The one thing that I like to do is, you know, put on a 6 to 10 foot tip, put on a lightly weighted crayfish imitation with maybe, you know, some schlop and feathers, for claws, something with like extra movement, and just swing it as slow as you ever swung a fly before, much slower than you swing, say, a steelhead fly. And the fish really seem to respond to that. So, but if you're in that situation, I know that Boris was asking about Skagit Head, that could definitely work, but I think you want to, in those midsummer, shallow flat, slow swinging crayfish pattern imitation situations, you want something that can land softly. You want to be able to control how it lands. So maybe a tapered poly tip instead of like a level sink tip in that case, and, you know, some emphasis on not kind of, you know, crashing down into that water. Yeah, so I think it absolutely has a place for fishing kind of targeting fish that are in the middle of the river and that are at depth, whether it's early in the season or whether it's in the summertime. And that's why we divided the book, not necessarily according to seasons, but according to the water column. Because right. There are going to be times where you're going to want to swing deep in the early season, and occasions where you'll want to swing deep in the, you know, in the summer. So yeah. Rather than kind of, you know, repeat the same information, we move through the water column.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's talk about the surface first. And you know, you've been kind of alluding to this along the way, but I've kind of broken it out into, you know, when do you fish, what do you fish with, the flies you use in tactics. So let's kind of break it down. Like, so when do you fish the surface? What are the telltale signs of working the surface over the middle or lower column?
Sure. Well, you're generally, you're starting down deep, and you're kind of moving closer to the surface as the water enters the 50s and starts to climb toward the 60s. So bass are becoming more active. They're beginning to look up. They're seeing more of their, you know, forage living up at the top of the surface. Frogs are moving across the water. You've got the first insect activity of the year. So it's going to vary on watershed, but generally if you've got steady temperatures, a warming pattern over the course of a couple of days, temperatures like in the 50-degree mark and like climbing towards 60, that's when you can start to fish on the surface. You won't do as well as, say, fishing down deep. But most of the people who fish on the surface are there because they want the excitement of a visual eat. So, again, that's the kind of, you know, thermometer-based thermometer answer.
Right.
But, you know, that's fish mood, right? So even throughout the course of the day, you're starting deep, the water's warming, you're, like, noting changes in the way that the fish is responding to the fly. It's eating it faster. It's eating on the strip and not on the paws. It's eating it closer to the top of the column. So it happens in the spring. And
what about the rest of the summer? Do you find less topwater activity as you move through the summer or more?
Certainly. I mean, more. I mean, once you get to August, you could be fishing topwaters all the time. Again, partly because it's the fly that you can present most effectively to the fish. So in very skinny water where you might have not a lot, in very skinny water you've got, you know, everything's very loud to a fish in that kind of environment. So throwing crayfish patterns, even if they're eating crayfish, that's likely to send them running. throwing a topwater pattern, that's likely to say, hey, I'm food, but I'm also not threatening. The land's soft, it's going to make minimal sound. So we really think a lot about sound in fishing for bass. There are times when sound is a really important and positive and good thing. So if it's early season, the water's high, it's ripping, the water's, you know, dark in color because we're dealing with some kind of runoff, that's when landing a fly heavy is going to do some good. The fish is down there. It's kind of in a stupor. It's 4 feet below the surface. Benefit from, you know, a knock on its head. That same fish in the same spot later in the year is going to flee from it. So it's worthwhile looking at your fly box and thinking of all your flies acoustically. Like, what kind of sound is it going to make when it lands, and what kind of sound is it going to make on the retrieves? That's one of the reasons that foam patterns are so, like, great. So let's say you've got really skinny water. You throw a popper out there, and you work the popper, you're just really displacing a lot of water, right? Sometimes a popper's too much. In those situations, the foam fly, which we call wigglies and are essentially kind of jacked up, you know, bluegill spider patterns, that's a great fly. It lands soft, and you just barely move its legs. It can, you know, it can say to the fish, I'm food, without communicating any kind of danger. So that's a big thing to think about in topwater situations. Again, so what kind of water am I fishing, and what kind of sound do I need to make on that water? If you're fishing topwaters you're fishing a bank that starts out shallow and gets progressively deeper, those first few pops are going to be quiet. The latter pops are going to get louder as the depth increases. If you're trying to kind of bring fish up out of, you know, deeper water, a diver fished really slowly and really chugged and kind of imploding in the water is a great, you know, sonic fly that can bring fish up from the depths. So that's another way that we kind of depart from the trout-centric thinking and thinking about the bass. We do think a lot about how the bass experiences sound. And I was fishing with my brother just the other week. He's a spinning angler, and we were fishing some low water in Illinois. And I saw him, he was throwing the same crayfish pattern that had worked so well for him early in the year when the river was up and the river had stain. And he's fishing that same pattern, and he's getting nothing. I'm throwing a baitfish pattern, a Murdich minnow. It's landing like a feather, but once it gets underwater, it's got serious profile. So that's one of the great things about fly fishing. I think low water smallmouth is really where the fly angler has, you know, one of the rare advantages over a spinning or baitcast angler. You can throw something substantial that lands softly. You can throw a bait fish that's not going to crash down, that's still going to swim big underneath the water. So I think a lot about sound when I'm approaching the water I'm fishing. Less important really early on, essential once we get to August.
Okay. Question from the Internet here. Rod in Amarillo asks, what are the optimum temperatures for smallies?
The best smallmouth fishing I've ever had was when the water was 90 degrees. It was
90 degrees?
The water was 90. This was a freakish heat spell maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It was central Wisconsin. Temps were over 100 degrees for 10 days. I think we set a record. And out of curiosity, I went out, and their metabolism was so high they could not stop eating. It was like they couldn't help themselves. So the smallmouth has been treated, again, as a cool water fish, and it does occupy, cool water portions of rivers, but I think that has less to do with, like, the actual temperature and more to do with, like, their preferred hunting grounds. They're going to fare a little bit better in slightly smaller water where they might have less competition from pike and muskies, where the edges are more abundant and more clearly defined. If you think of your, you know, big warm water systems, once you get kind of to the end of those systems where they dump off into lakes and what have you, you don't have a lot of edges there to hunt. You've got kind of big muddy basins. You don't have sharp drop-offs. All the structure tends to be man-made in those
types of areas, wood walls, riprap, and what have you. By contrast, those tributaries that flow into those rivers, they're smaller, they have a lot of seams. But I bring that up because bass really respond well to heat. It's not a fish where you, if it's 95 degrees and you're thinking it's too hot for the smallmouth bass, you are thinking the wrong way. Like, their metabolism increases, and again, 90 degrees, couldn't keep the fly out of their mouth. I hope to never fish water hotter than that ever again. It was largely an experiment for me, but the heat is your friend. So if you're suffering from the heat, it's actually a pretty good day to be smallmouth fishing.
Okay. What, any special equipment do you use for the surface? Weight, rods, length, anything in particular?
Sure. There was a great question about, you know, what three rods I would carry if I could only carry three. And the answer would be a slightly slower 7-weight, like a medium fast, and with a conventionally tapered, like a trout taper floating line. So fishing the Reddington Crux new rod, really nice, quick but not too fast, not a broomstick, allows you to really control speed of delivery, control your landing, kind of working close. So I would, as one of my rods, I would have a slower 7-weight for those in-close situations where precision casting is really going to make the difference between a fish and no fish. Again, a lot of situations I can think about where this cast is going to get a fish and this cast is not going to get a fish. And so for the waiting angler, a slightly slower 7-weight is a really great tool. The conventionally tapered kind of trot line, like the Scientific Angler MPX, which used to be the old GPX taper. The reason for that is you have like a belly and a rear taper on those lines because they're designed for mending on the water and for aerial mending. And that level of line control is really important when you're fishing skinny water with delicate flies, small poppers, and wigglies. As the offerings get larger, a more aggressive weight forward taper is a good line to go with and a rod that can throw that line. So a 7 or 8 weight faster action rod, 7 weight for maybe smaller top waters, and then the 8 weight for maybe some larger bait fish patterns. But again, like, still trying to keep a belly in that line because you're river fishing. So you can get a really aggressive weight forward taper with no, it looks like a skagit head. It doesn't have a rear taper. Got a really short weight distribution. And those lines are tough to work with. It's tough to control your casting, tough to control your mending. Once that line gets on the water, it gets pulled a lot. So especially if you're, you know, fishing kind of wigglies and poppers, it's not good to have line that's kind of unruly once it hits the water. So for topwater fishing, we're thinking of lines that give you the opportunity to control your presentation. Also with topwater fishing, there are occasions where you want to, especially if you're like you're sight fishing or maybe you've got fish rising to something, you make a long cast, a fish appears 10 yards downstream, you want to recast immediately. Hard to do with a shooting head type of line where you have to strip everything in back to the head and kind of like reload and cast that way. For the conventional trout taper for the topwaters, you can pick it up at distance and lay it back down, one false cast. So it makes you, it gives you a lot more capacity. So, of course, it can be harder to turn over certain flies, but that's, you know, an occasion to work on your double hauling and become a better caster.
Brian Cause in northern Michigan, near you, asks, what is your key to getting non-active bronzebacks to strike a fly? Is color more important than retrieve, change fly? Cause one.
Great. Well, shout out to Cause, good friend of mine. Fish with him all the time.
Do you?
So, really, I found it's largely retrieve. Again, the trout-centric way of thinking is I've got to keep this fly moving, and as the fish gets closer, I've got to make it escape all the quicker, which is not going to seal the deal a lot of the times with bass. They really like to eat on the paws. It's not always the case, but stopping your fly can be a great way to get a fish to eat. A lot of the times, if you're kind of doing a typical trout retrieve, you've got a following fish, you kind of speed it up and make it more erratic, the fish will follow, but it won't commit. And then we'll see the boat, and then it'll slink away. So, like, fishing much slower, stopping the fly, or if moving it very minimally. So we talk a lot in the book about the importance of using your eyes and being able to see if you've got a fish laid up underneath your popper, laid up underneath a wiggly. A small movement is going to entice the fish to eat, not a large movement. So a big part of the book is, and I think a big part of smallmouth fishing is kind of, it's this small game that it seems really easy. We can call them micro movements, but it's actually quite hard. It's hard to kind of manipulate the fly minimally. It's easy to do a big strip. But it's hard to, say, move a wiggly just enough. It's hard to impart to, you know, a gut-sized soft tackle just enough pulse to convey, you know, the impression of life without too much action. So if I were to give one tip to any smallmouth angler, it would be to kind of, like, think in a Jedi or Zen way about small things happening at the end of your line, micro movements and flies, as opposed to, you know, if you're fishing streamers for trout, a micro movement is not going to seal the deal on a following bass trout, but a micro movement might seal the deal on a following bass. Another thing that I've found is, you know, changing the fly up can be a big, you know, big thing. If a fish kind of, like, follows a baitfish pattern out from the bank, and it's following it less like it wants to eat it, more like it wants to see it off, throwing something that has a that moves differently, that drops vertically, for instance, as opposed to kind of coming through the column, that could be really effective as well. So, yeah, thinking about how that fly is moving through the water and how you can move differently. So going from a horizontal presentation to a vertical presentation. If a fly, if a fish is curious about a, you know, baitfish swimming through the column but not committing, it might be really curious about something falling, you know, through the column.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the middle column and the lower column and finish up with that. So stick with me, folks. We'll be right back. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, and the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Dave Karzinski about smallmouth strategies. If you'd like to ask Dave a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But Dave, I did get another question here on the Internet I wanted to get from early on. Len up in Middleton, I don't know Middleton what, but he lives in Middleton. If you have to choose one streamer to use all the time, which pattern and what size would it be?
Yeah, great question. Okay, so... the
Dynamite?
Convenient answer for me would be like, you know, invoke a number of different water situations, but I want to do justice to this question. If it had to be one, I guess it would be. I mean, it would have to be a merge minnow because it has a big enough ripple to get noticed that the water is kind of stained or high. But it also, you can land it pretty softly and you can work it pretty minimally. You know, by just, you know, working it with your wrist and the rod, you can get those, you know, flashy blue tail fibers to kind of swim in a really subtle way. You could also, you know, strip it big and get some swimming side-to-side action, so you have some capability there. And if I had to do a size, you know, it can be hard with mortgages. The hook sizes vary so widely. So a TMC 8089 in a size 2, which is that's a huge hook. So I would throw it on a size 6 TMC 8089. That's going to turn out to be like a 4-inch fly. And again, that fly can be, the way you fish it, you can make it seem a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller. So that 4-inch fly fish really aggressively, it's going to move more water. It's going to make more sound underwater. It's going to kind of call fish up and flash more. You can also fish it more subtly. So I'd go Murtich minnow, in a size, when I say size 6, size 6 TMC 8089, which is essentially kind of a 3.5, 4-inch fly. That'll cover a lot of bases there.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, let's talk about the middle column then. So the question is, again, when do you fish the middle column?
Yeah. You can fish the middle column almost year round. So the middle column, the middle column is our kind of biggest space, in the book. It's just below the surface and just above the bottom. So we're swimming a lot of things through there, and it covers a lot of territory. We're looking at the jig flies, like the clouder or the circus peanut, and also the neutrally buoyant bait fish patterns. So it's never really a bad time to fish in the middle column. One of the things we talk about in the book is the type of water that you are fishing, whether the primary structure runs along the y-axis, kind of parallel to the bank, or the x-axis, kind of perpendicular to the bank. So the classic y-axis presentation would be something dead drifted. It's kind of flowing along a shelf. It's flowing along structure that runs parallel to the bank. But we have the opposite kind of river. We have like these gnarly holes. You have lots of bend pools, irregular holes. You've got different types of structure between you and the bank. That's a great place to fish a bait fish because you can really control where it goes in the water. You can make a cast to a prime line and then throughout the retrieve swim it past other prime lines. So that's one of the cool things about the middle column patterns. You kind of chart their course. So when you're in a river and you're making a cast, you can have a target, I'm going to fish that, piece of fallen wood. But after you've, fished through that and nothing's happened, what other structure exists along the retrieve? So by kind of pausing and letting the fly drift downstream, you can swim that thing across other structures. So that's one of the really cool things about baitfish patterns, especially neutrally buoyant ones, where you can kind of hang that fly for a while if you're not using too heavy a line. So you can really
What are some of those other patterns that you like? I know you've got a book here.
Russ Madden's Flash Monkey is a really fantastic middle column pattern. Has a lot of flash, great swim side-to-side action. Not a fly that you want to fish subtly, kind of more of a big, brash, in-your-face fly. Mike Schultz's Swing and D pattern family of flies, incredible action. It's mostly neutrally buoyant, but they have this great foam head, which allows the fly to rise up a little bit on the paws. So in this sense, you can swim the fly over wood. So one of the kind of cool changes in fly fishing streamer language over the past couple of years is, this term swim fly. And I like the word swim fly as opposed to streamer because it really speaks to the ability to and the benefit from actively manipulating your fly. If we think about the classic trout streamer, this was, something left to be, quarter downstream or casting at a 45-degree angle, we're letting it swing across with the current. That's our streamer. We can control the course of the fly to a degree, but not as much as if we are fishing, a neutrally buoyant baitfish pattern from a moving boat where you really are plotting the fly's course. Where can I swim it through? Where's a likely holding pattern? So it becomes kind of a fun, especially if you're fishing from a moving boat, it becomes a really fun way to fish because your attention is always on the river. You're always looking for not only where am I going to start the swim, but where am I going to end it, what's going to be in the middle, how do I work that fly through various areas. And in that sense, I think it borrows a lot from the northern Michigan trout fishing culture. So a lot of those patterns, I mean, Russ Madden's pattern, the circus peanut, and the slash monkey, which are both wonderful smallmouth patterns, were originally developed for trout. But that kind of Kelly Gallup, Russ Madden,
Kelly's from Michigan.
I think that's, yeah. So,
Rod from Amarillo asked, what are the depths of the middle column? What do you consider the middle column?
And you know what? In this case, we're not even thinking of whether it's 20 feet deep or whether it's 10 feet deep or 5 feet deep. We're thinking of the middle column as below the surface and above the bottom. So it has less to do with feet. It's more kind of a relative place that's going to vary in size depending on your river. And again, that has to do with letting the river kind of make the choice about what kind of fly you're going to throw, letting the structure kind of help make a choice about what kind of fly you're going to throw. If I have a lot of structure that's really running parallel to the river and fish are holding to that, if I'm throwing out a baitfish pattern and swimming it back to the boat every cast, it's only spending a small portion of its time in a productive area. That would be a better place to throw something that I can fish along that structure. If it's a middle column fly, it's a lightly weighted middle column fly like a tequila that you can just mend through that area. So you're almost kind of trying to see how far you can, you know, fish that fly without it hanging up parallel to the bank. So, yes, that's how I would think about the middle column.
I was going to say, what kind of line are you using for that middle column? The sinking tip or sinking line?
It's going to depend a little bit on the depth of the river. You can get by on a floating line. And, in fact, Chuck Kraft, a great Mid-Atlantic guide and fly innovator, he loves floating lines because he believes that they more accurately induce, you know, in a fly, the wounded minnow motion, which is always kind of like spasming but rising up toward the surface. So he's almost always fishing his patterns on floating lines. A lot of patterns on floating lines aren't going to be able to kind of like cut through the meniscus all that easily, in which case an intermediate line becomes a really great tool. We talk in the book about, you know, an intermediate line with a couple of tips that allows you to fish from just below the surface to further down in the column. So if you don't want to carry a lot of, you know, rods in the boat, and, you know, who does, an intermediate line is a fantastic smallmouth line. Should be in every, you know, angler's toolkit, especially if they're a boat angler.
Okay, good. And any other comments you want to make on the middle column before we move on to the lower column?
Sure. Well, the middle column is really important because it's a place where fish almost always feel comfortable eating. Fish are not always going to feel comfortable eating on the surface. It's a dangerous place. If, you know, water is low, they're not necessarily going to feel comfortable there. But they're comfortable chasing things through the middle part of the column. And there's all kinds of different moves that you can make a fly do in the middle part of the column. So, for instance, the Chuck Kraft minnow that I referenced earlier, it, you know, it's neutrally buoyant, but it sinks a bit on the pause. So on the strip, it's going to rise up. Whereas Mike Schultz's swinging D family of flies, on the strip, it's going to cut through the column. It's going to rise on the pause. So, again, thinking about the structure that you're fishing is going to help you make the right choice about what fly to fish. If you've got a lot of wood, submerged wood that you need to swim the fly over, the swinging D is a great fly because you can fish it down at depth. Once you get to your obstacle, you can pause the fly, it's going to float up, and you can fish it back down. So it allows you to kind of slither over wood as opposed to, you know, getting hung up in it. And that's exactly why Mike developed the pattern. He was losing, you know, too many flies with clients to wood. So, again, if fish are going to respond to a bait fish, you have a lot of different choices about how to make that decision. Another is the size of the lie that you're fishing. Maybe you're in faster water, you've got a boulder seam. You need a fly that's going to kind of get down very quickly to depth, which would rule out, you know, a Murdich minnow or something that is going to kind of spend its first second or two after landing way up on the surface. In that case, something with weight, a clouser, a surface T-net, you make the cast, it's going to drop right in front of the fish's face, with an upstream aerial man, you've got enough slack where you can kind of, you know, dangle the fly there before it swings. It's in the fish's face a little bit longer. So when we're thinking about these patterns, we're thinking about how do we, you know, get a fly into a fish's face? How do we get it there for the longest amount of time? And how do we keep it from hanging up? So those are some of the, you know, the cool things to think about when we're making a whole column streamer decision.
Okay, let's talk about the lower column. And we did get a couple of questions on that. Phil in Kentucky wrote in, he says, recently Mille Lacs Lake in Minnesota was the location of a tournament in which numerous 5-pound smallmouth were caught on spinning gear in relatively deep water. What techniques can fly fishermen employ with sinking lines to increase their chances of catching trophy smallmouth in locations where the fish are deep? So that kind of introduces us to the lower column.
It does not get much lower than that. There's a limit to how deep we can effectively fish in moving water with a fly line. One of the things we talk about in the book is the fastest way to get deep is actually with a floating line, a weighted fly, sparsely dressed, and an untapered leader. So as opposed to, you know, a thick butt section, you know, a midsection and a tippet, just 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 feet of straight 10-pound mono or fluoro. That stuff falls through the water very quickly. I mean, it's essentially, you know, the last 10 feet of any spinning rod outfit.
Right.
So that gets you down fastest. It's great for y-axis presentations when you're drifting with the current, when you're fishing parallel to the bank, when you're, you know, dead drifting a larger streamer in kind of nymphing fashion. But to answer Phil's question, I mean, fishing deep in lakes, you're not contending with currents. You could count down a weighted streamer, or even an unweighted streamer, on a longer sink tip, like a full sinking line. You're going to be doing a lot of wading there, but that might be the way to get down deep. It's, you know, fishing deep is going to be a situation where I feel strongly that you don't really lose a lot of advantage in fly fishing. Fishing deep in lakes for bass, you lose a little bit of the advantage of the fly. But I guess if I were tasked with doing that, I would experiment with a full sinking line and maybe even like a streamer that kind of rose up on the paws, or a diver, so I could like strip down toward the bottom and let it kind of rise up on the paws. Or I think a lot of those guys, you know, fishing down deep for the smallmouth, they tend to be doing very finesse presentations and very vertical presentations. So you could do, a longer, 12, 13, 14-foot untapered leader with a weighted, smaller crayfish imitation. It would be terrible to cast, but once you got it down, you could actually kind of vertical jig at distance using kind of a more buoyant fly line that you'd maybe want to, hit up with some paillette paste. So that's how I would approach a lake. I should note that though we do have, one lake guru, Luke Kovayich out of Ashland, Wisconsin in the book, it is, by and large a river book. So
right. The
lake smallmouth angler buying this book is going to get some great info, but it's really designed for the river angler.
Yeah. David Bond in Fort Collins, Colorado, yes, the smallmouth river I fish for smallmouth bass in central Wisconsin, we use sinking Rapalas 2 inches long in the orange color. What is a good fly substitute for that lure?
Yeah, well, I wonder if David and I fish the same river. Maybe I'll see him out there next year. I fish a lot of Central Wisconsin rivers. Well, a sinking Rapala, so there we've got, he says sinking, not diving, so I'm guessing it's a countdown. I would think a not just loosely buoyant pattern, but one fished on an intermediate line that's going to kind of hover on the paws and kind of suspend neutrally. A 2-inch Rapala, that's a little bit small and subtle. I would go with a smaller Murdich minnow. If I'm tying my own, I'm hitting it up with an orange marker, the color in the Asta is on top, and maybe throwing some orange bucktail into the tail. If the water is a little bit low and clear, dark side, soft tackle, I mentioned it a couple of times. I love fishing it. It always gets torn up. I usually, you know, get one fly destroyed per outing. That's why you're going to have to tie yourself, not commercially made anymore. But, again, you know, one white marabou, one orange marabou, a feather, a couple turns of each, and I think you've got a pretty reasonable Rapala imitation.
Okay. Being that the, and we've only got a couple minutes left here, being that the deep column or the lower column is harder to fish, whether it be in the river or what specific tactics that you haven't talked about already would you use to fish that column?
Sure. So vertical dredging from a moving boat where we are not nymphing because we want to impart movement to the fly. And it's also not nymphing because, you know, we're using, like, you know, a somewhat substantial-sized streamer. But it is nymphing in that we're trying to follow, you know, an edge, be it a current edge or a shelf edge where shallower water bumps down to deep. While it might look to the fish similar to nymphing, there are a couple of key differences. So we're using a floating line, brightly colored tip, maybe a nymphing line, because we're going to be watching the tip of that line for strikes. The fly line is going to have a little belly in it. It's going to be floating along with the boat, but ahead of the boat with a belly. And we want some current pushing on that line because that's going to prevent the fly from getting hung up. Because we really are kicking the bottom here for this really early season technique, which would, you know, probably work in, you know, 40 degree water if you wanted to try that. And this is done with an untapered leader. So this is, a tapered leader is going to just pull and parachute that fly upward, away from the water column. So when we're thinking about those kinds of dredging patterns, we really want a fly that kind of gets down fast, stays there, and then also doesn't kind of like rise up of its own accord. So a heavily dressed pattern is going to catch a lot of current. It's going to swing up off the bottom. So we're looking at patterns that have kind of a compromise. Sparsely dressed, but they have, you know, the materials that they do have are natural, and they move, you know, rapid fur. Like the meat whistle is a great fly. It's tied on a 90-degree jig hook, which prevents it from hanging up on the bottom. Smaller collar, you know, you've got, you know, one rabbit strip there. So we're able to fish that fly down deep. It doesn't have an excess material that's going to kind of kick it upward. Fishing it with the boat on an untapered leader that allows the fly to kind of get down and stay down. So you're kind of vertical jigging at a distance away from the boat, I guess is the best way to think about that. And you're watching the tip of the fly line for a very subtle eat. That's the way that I would kind of really think about that technique. And a lot of it depends on boat control. If anybody out there in vertical jigs for walleyes, you know, boat control is really important when it comes to maintaining bottom contact. You want to move, you want to be paying attention to the current as it's moving. It's speeding up or slowing down. So it's an instance where the guy on the boat should be watching the tips of the lines to kind of slow the boat down if it needs slowing down, speed it up if it needs speeding up. So it's a tough presentation because fish are lethargic. They're not really active. To get them to eat, you really got to put it in their face. And to put it in their face, you've got to make long, sustained, you know, presentations that require a fair amount of boat control. So that's one way of approaching, you know, the bottom of the column, vertical dredging with untapered lines. There's also stripping, swimming streamers back more slowly. Here's where we're using, you know, heavier sink tips. Maybe you're going to throw, you know, a 12 to 16 foot sink tip to get a weighted streamer down to depth. So here's where we would think of the weighted variation of some of the neutrally buoyant patterns. So patterns that have lead eyes, patterns that get down and stay down a little bit longer. So that would be the way that we would approach the deeper water. And for the wading angler, swinging on longer, heavier tips, heavier flies, in a style maybe more akin to steelhead swinging.
Okay. Good. Well, we've run out of time. Got to shut things off here for the evening. But a lot of great information, Dave. Thanks for all that that you've shared tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Hang on here for a few more minutes. We're going to give some prizes away, including your book. So when we return, we'll give a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and a copy of Dave's book, Smallmouth: Modern Fly Fishing Methods, Tactics, and Techniques, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And find more about what Stackpole has to offer, go to stackpolebooks.com, and you can see all the books that they have there in the fly fishing topic area. So we'll be right back after this quick break. Listen closely if you've ever fished Alaska and Alaska's Bristol Bay region. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The pebble mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Salmon fishermen, Alaska Native organizations in the Bristol Bay area, and environmental groups have been fighting the proposed gold, copper, and molybdenum mine for more than a decade, saying it imperils the world's largest salmon run, a significant source of income for Alaskans. Trump's EPA has reversed an Obama administration decision to prevent progress of this mine, and so it opens the doors for the mining company to apply for permits and start mining. So anglers across the country are joining the fight against this. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more about how you can get involved. Again, SaveBristolBay.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments, and we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on getting some of these great prizes. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with the information on how to receive your prize. So first, we'll be giving away a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So I'll fire up the database here, and let's see, the first winner is Brian Kaminsky in Michigan. Oh, that's good. In smallmouth territory there. So congratulations, Brian. You won yourself a 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and I know you'll love being a part of that organization. Okay, the second prize we're going to give away is a subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, which you can learn more about at amatobooks.com, amatobooks.com. And our winner for that is Wayne Johnson in California. So congratulations, Wayne, on that 1-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So great, and congratulations to both you guys. And now we'll give away a copy of Dave's book, Smallmouth, courtesy of Stackpole Books. And let me clear my queue here. So I got a 2-part question for you all tonight, and it is this. Dave, early in the show, talked about a specific kind of head on a streamer that would push a lot of water. I want to know what that head was made of. And then I want to know, what part of the retrieve do the smallmouth hit most often? What part of the retrieve does smallmouth hit most often? So two-part question. Give me those answers, and the first one that does gets Dave's book. So now we have to
those
wait.
Those are good questions.
Yeah. Well, two things I learned from tonight. I mean, two of many, but yeah, that resonated with me. So, I think we got it here. Let's see here. Just give me a second. And we've got Ed Constantini says wool in the paws. Is that it?
Got it. Wool and the paws, so that's a great name for a fly.
Wool paws. Yeah. Oh, the kind of his name? I didn't hear what you said.
Oh no, the wool and the paws would be a great streamer that Ed could develop.
Yeah.
It's a great,
yeah.
Great fly name.
Good. Well, Ed, congratulations. I've got your email, I've got your name. You need to send me your address, so we can get Stackpole to send you a book. So, and we had some other winners here. Let's see, just a little bit slower. David Willem. Let's see who else answered. Dick, you said foam and drop paws, a little off there. You entered a lot of them, David. Gosh, you just weren't first. So anyway, good playing, everyone, and thanks for playing, and better luck next time if you didn't win. And by the way, we can Ed, you can just put that address in the same text box that you answered the question in, and I'll get that through there. So thanks, everybody, for participating tonight. We really appreciate it. And Dave, many thanks to you for being on the show. And I know it's late. You had a long day at the university today, and thanks for a super long day. On the east, in
it's
Eastern
always
time,
fun to talk about bass.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, thanks for all your time. Hopefully everybody has found the archive on our website. If you haven't yet, there's a couple of links on it on our homepage and at the bottom of every page. In it, you'll find past shows, over 250 shows, which can be searched by keyword or keyword phrase, like trout, tarpon, smallmouth bass, whatever, or river or fishery or lake. Go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you're going to discover in that archive. Our next broadcast will be on October 18th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I don't have a guest for you or a topic yet. We had a last-minute cancellation today, so I will try to replace that with somebody great, as always, and just look for my announcements in the homepage, and you'll see who that's going to be. I'd like to thank the International Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Whippray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster Rafts, and Baja Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.